We're talking about World War II experiences of Lash LaRue, and you were mentioning you were in Palestine with a British colonel.
Yeah, we drove from Cairo. I don't know how the hell we got across the canal, but somehow we did. And he had been in command of a force in the 30s, which protected the Jewish settlers when they were settling what is now Israel. Mm-hmm. And we'd be driving along, and we'd look up, and there'd be a hillside running up maybe 300 feet or so up into the air there, and it'd be grass, green grass, but covered with huge white boulders. And he would say, "Look, you see those boulders there?" I'd say, "Yeah." He'd say, "The goddamn, or the bloody Arabs with their white outfits would hide behind those boulders and snipe at us going." And sort of reminded me of movies of the Wild West where mm-hmm.
they would snipe at the cowboys.
And yeah. And then he'd point to a little village on top of one of these places, and he'd say that, yeah. He'd say, we knew there were Arabs up there who were shooting at us, but and we tried to eliminate them. But we'd creep up there in the nighttime, not making a sound, and we'd think, boy, we're going to make it this time. And we'd be maybe 100 feet from that village, and the dogs would start barking.
first line of defense.
We stopped off at the, it was a great experience. We stopped off one night at the King David Hotel, which is where Begin and his Irgun terrorists blew up, killed 19 German British officers or something. Yeah. You remember that after World War II? Anyway, they installed me in an apartment in Aleppo, and we had about 30 ambulances attached to the British 10th Army, which was all around the area there out in the desert in Syria, training for the invasion of Sicily. And so my job, I had a Jeep and a driver, and because nobody knew whether I was an officer or what the hell I was, I would go to a unit where one of my drivers was working, and I'd go into the officer's mess and have drinks, a good meal. Or if I wanted to, I could go into the British non-coms mess.
Mm-hmm. You're headed both ways.
Yeah. So that was really great. But after, I think, 3 months of that, my year was up and I came back home. So that's when I re-enrolled at the University of Washington in economics.
And you ended up in the U.S. Army at some
point. Yeah, I came back, and I left something out there. What I noticed was when I was pursuing the Africa Corps with the British 8th Army, and they put four wounded people in the ambulance on stretches, the policy we adopted there, which apparently the U.S. Army has not followed since World War II, and I don't know if they ever did it in World War II. They must have in World War II. But the policy was, when we would get to an aid station, somebody, an orderly there, would say, who comes off first? And the answer would be, this guy here. And it didn't make any difference whether the guy who came off first was a German soldier, or an Indian, or a New Zealander, a free Frenchman, or a Greek, or whatever it was, you know, whether it was on our side or their side. They took him off in order of the person most urgently in need of medical treatment. And so the chivalry of the old days still survived. Mm-hmm. So then I began to realize, if I put somebody in that ambulance who had his leg blown off, and he was a German, it didn't bother me emotionally at all. But if he was on our side, it really got to me emotionally. So I said to myself, hell, I really want us to win. I should be fighting. I shouldn't be on the sidelines like this. So when I came home, I just went down, enlisted in the Army, put me through basic training out in California. No recognition of my experience with the British, mm-hmm. or in peacetime. And I had an Army serial number, which identified me to anybody who was looking at these records as virtually a lifer, because I was in there back in the 30s. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever mentioned that. So I just went through basic training for the infantry the way everybody else did. But they called me, I don't know if it would be recognition. I think it was because I had all but one quarter to go to finish college. I was called off the training field one day in basic training camp, and I went over to a building where they were interviewing possible trainees with a view towards sending them to officers training corps, training camp. So it was the damnedest experience. This is one of these wooden buildings, temporary wooden building. If I'm right, I think there are about five officers sitting at a table facing the candidate. And then behind the candidate was a wall of windows, kind of push up. And as you look through the windows, you saw the boys out there marching around and doing exercise and all that. So they said to me, stand facing those windows and pretend that you're commanding a battalion. Well, I don't have a piercing voice, you know, so I'm giving battalion attention, parade, rest, all that kind of crap. And after a few minutes of that, they said, don't call us, we'll call you. So I was shipped out to Hawaii and assigned, I was at Schofield Barracks for a while as a replacement, you know, an individual replacement, and you never knew where you were going to be sent. So I think I stayed out of Schofield Barracks. That's about 30 miles, I think, from Honolulu.
What year was this now? 44?
44, yeah. Mm-hmm. Wait a minute.
Or was it?
Yeah, it would have to be 44. Because I had 42, 43. I can't remember for sure. It was either 43 or 44.
Okay.
Anyway, they gave me a job driving officers from Schofield into Honolulu for recreation. So I'd be driving these in, you know, like a chauffeur, you know. They go in and have drinks, and I'd stand outside. Or I don't think I had enough sense to get a book to read. I just waited for these guys. Well, that way, I didn't mind that too much. But one day, as we're driving into town, there were two lieutenants in the back, and one of them had just arrived from the States, one of these 90-day wonder ROTC types. And the other had been in some battle out in one of the islands somewhere. So the new man said to the other one, says, what's it like killing Japs? He says, does it bother you? The guy says, bother me? Hell no. He says, it's like shooting rats at a water hole. And I kind of ran off the road. I was so shocked at that. But later I found out that I felt pretty much the same way.
So anyway,
and here we get to an incident that bears on this interview so far as explaining how did I get to be the way I am. I was in a kind of a MASH outfit. Assigned me to that in Hawaii. We went out into the countryside and trained for, maybe 2 months or something. And they made a sergeant out of me and put me in charge of 30 ambulances. And now we see some
connection with connection. Your other experience. Yeah.
But it turned out to be unfortunate in a way for them, because as I looked around at this outfit I was in, I said to myself, there's something wrong with everybody else in this outfit. They're all eight balls. There's something wrong. They've all screwed up in some other outfit and they've been dumped in here. So what in the hell am I doing in here? Here I am, a good boy, you know, they carried my bunk out.
Good soldier.
Yeah. So I was criticizing the captain and the first sergeant for the way they ran things. So one day I'm in the mess hall having lunch. Everybody else left except the first sergeant, who was a lifer, and me. So he says, hey, Lou, come over here. So I went over. He says, I just want you to know something. He says, the captain and I know you're a communist. I had joined the Young Communist League, but I got out of it in about 3 months when I figured out what democratic centralism meant. Mm-hmm. You know, you debate for 2 hours in your little group, and then at the end of the 2 hours, the guy who's heads it up says, well, that was an interesting discussion, but what the party says about this is this. It was a total waste of your time. Mm-hmm. So 3 months is all I could stand of that. But I never considered that being a communist anyway. So I said, wait a minute, what makes you think that? He says, well, you're always criticizing the captain and me. That was his idea.
He's being a communist.
So I went to the captain and I said, I went to AWOL. They sent us into the Philippines. We got to the Philippines and went ashore the same day MacArthur did. I didn't see him, but I'll think of that when I see pictures of him walking ashore. Mm-hmm. It's the same day we arrived there.
The restaging of his returning.
So we were sent down to a little fishing village there, and from time to time the wounded would be brought down from the battle area north or wherever it was by barge. And they'd come off the barge and we'd take him into our little field hospital there. We were so far to the rear, I couldn't even hear artillery. That's how safe that was. See. So one day, when I got acquainted with some of the local people because they'd go down swimming and they'd be fishing and all that. Guy says to me, "How'd you like to go to a wedding?" This is a Filipino. I said, "Great." And he says, "Let's go." So we start walking. Pretty soon we're out of town and we're going up a hill. And it starts to get dark. I said, "Wait a minute, where the hell is this wedding?" "Oh, it's just a little farther." So we stayed overnight and then we stayed another night. I think it took us 3 days to get to the wedding. Mm-hmm. We caroused for a couple of days. It started back. I've now been gone a week. Mm-hmm. That's AWOL. People have gone to jail for that. Mm-hmm. So I got back and the guy, one of the other guys in this unit, as I approached the field hospital, he says, "Hey, LaRue, the captain wants to talk to you." And boy, he's mad. So the captain says, you're no longer a sergeant, you're a private." Well, who gives a damn, you know, in wartime? So I didn't care about that. But then I thought, this is a good time for me to get the hell out of this outfit. So I said to the captain, "How do I get out of this? I want to transfer to the infantry." "Well," he says, "I'm not going to allow it." I said, "Well, there must be an appeal I can take from your decision." "Oh, yeah," he says, "you can go." I think it was called Inspector General or something. So I went to see the Inspector General, told him I wanted to transfer out. He said, "Where do you want to go?" I says, "To the infantry." He damn near fell off his chair. He said, "Nobody volunteers for the infantry. You've got to be nuts." I said, "Well, that's the way I feel." So he said, "Okay." So he transferred me into the infantry. And that was the best damn decision I ever made, because it was, especially after this chicken shit outfit I was in with this screwball captain and first sergeant and all that. Because this was the 7th Infantry Division, which is an old regular army division, but it had been put on the shelf, whatever the term is, between the two wars. And then it was reactivated by General Vinegar Joe Stilwell, who was my kind of a guy. And his stamp, which he put on that, was, "This is not going to be a spit and polish division. This is going to be a fighting division, but it's going to be kind of as much as you can make a military outfit, a kind of a democratic outfit." Mm-hmm. So one example of why I liked it was, after I joined it, I found out that next door to us was the 77th Infantry Division. And they had fought in the battle for this island. It was Leyte Island. And so they were resting. Well, we all waited to go aboard ships and go to some other island. So here we are sitting around, not doing a damn thing. We look over here, and here's these guys in the 77th painting their, you know what Blanco is?
No.
Well, you know what webbing is.
Yes. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. If you want that to look as sharp, see, like MPs, you mm-hmm. paint that stuff white.
Oh.
And then you go into combat, you got to clean it off. Uh-huh. So they're over there blankoing all their web equipment, oh, yeah. You know, straps and packs and everything. Mm-hmm. It looked like a goddamn MP outfit. And we're just, all we had to do was keep our rifles clean mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and fall out for reveille and mm-hmm. retreat. And the rest of the time we're playing cards mm-hmm. or having to swim or mm-hmm. something. I thought, boy, this is the outfit for me. So then the captain calls me in and he says, "I see here," he had my file, he says, "I see you have some college." He said, "Well, you got here just at the right time." He said, "You've got to send somebody to chemical warfare school." That had an ominous sound to mm-hmm. me. I said, what happens there? He said, "Well, you learn how to operate a flamethrower, which you carry on your back. Two tanks, you know, one with napalm, the other compressed air, something like that. Rubber hoses that come out. You push one lever and the napalm shoots out, push the other one and, or squeeze it, it ignites a spark and flame shoots up. So I knew this was bad news. I go over there. So the training consisted of some guys telling me, put this on your back. So I put it on my back. I didn't know what it weighed, 40 pounds or something like that. Some other guy comes up behind me, opens the valves. Now I can activate the flamethrower. That's how I just described to you the entire training program.
That was the training.
So I went back and I said to the captain, Captain, I said, that flamethrower is heavy. I said, there, I see some big guys around here. Why don't you send that to one of them? Oh, you'll never carry it in combat. He says, what you'll do is train them now that you've learned how to. I wound up carrying the goddamn thing when we landed on Okinawa. And I remember as we came down the way we got aboard the landing craft was come down the side of the ship on those cargo nets, you know. And down at the, on the ocean level, the barge, the waves would push the barge away from the ship and then back, you know, and it'd be banging up against the side of the ship. And it, you had to drop about 3 feet, I guess, from the bottom of the cargo net into this barge. And all the time I'm climbing down there, all I'm worrying about is, what if the goddamn barge moves away from the ship just when I jump into it and I go into the water, I'll never come up.
You got a 40-pound anchor on your back.
Well, I managed to make it, so I carried that damn thing. And it, we landed on April 1, 1945. The weather was very much like the weather would be in Portland or Seattle, temperate to climate at that time. So I can remember just sweating. We climb up hills and down hills and up and down. My uniform turned white from the salt that I was, and I was popping the damn salt pills until I was nauseated. I only had to use it twice, but but then I got rid of it, and nobody else, I never taught anybody how to use one. We just stopped using them for some reason.
Did you use it against the bunkers or caves?
Yeah,
or?
See, the Okinawa consisted of a lot of hills, and I don't know how high they were, several hundred feet, I guess, maybe 500 feet high, at the base of which there were caves, in addition to which there were caves that were excavated by the Okinawans to bury their dead, and they would put the body into a huge ceramic urn about 3.5 feet high. Okinawans were fairly small people. They put the body in that urn, and then they'd take it in, and then they'd seal up the entrance to this cave they had excavated. Some of them had, and you see them there today. I went back in 95 for the 50th anniversary of that battle. And I was reminded of how the entrances to some of these were ornamented with bright colored tiles and whatnot. But those caves and the artificial caves were perfect pillboxes for a Japanese machine gunner, who of course was in there to die. It was a suicidal assignment, or he wasn't going to emerge. Chances are he'd never get out of there. But it was great for them because we'd be moving along, and all of a sudden this guy would open up with a machine gun and take out maybe 10 people with a couple of bursts. So they would call for me. Now there were, in addition to mine, there were tanks that had these things mounted on them, and they, God, they could throw flame out there, oh, probably the length of a football field. A hell of a thing to watch. Of course, it's your side using this. It's kind of nice to watch.
Not on the receiving end.
Yeah. So anyway, that turned out to be a good experience. I graduated to being a rifleman, and I finally was discharged as a staff sergeant. So there again, given the turnover of second lieutenants, I was in command of a platoon for about a month, I guess, and I didn't realize this until fairly recently somehow, but it was the day before that battle ended. It was getting dark, and there'd been a sniper in some, there were a lot of coral boulders. I guess the Okinawa must have been coral that somehow had pushed up out of the ocean. And so there, this guy was in among some of these boulders, and he was picking off members of my platoon. And we couldn't move. We called up a tank to come up there. And the tank came up, and I don't think the tank was any farther than from here to the blackboard there, you know.
Maybe 20 feet?
20 feet or so. Mm-hmm. Fired his cannon right into those boulders. And I thought, well, that's the end of that son of a bitch. We can move. We started to move. By God, he came out of somewhere, started picking people off again. So we just couldn't make any headway, and it started to get dark. So I was saying to one of the people in the platoon, you dig a split trench here, and somebody dig one here, and you know, that kind of thing, bed down for the night. When all of a sudden, wham, this guy got me right through the shoulder. And I've always thought of it as a million-dollar wound, you know, because you get out of combat, mm-hmm. but you survive.
But it didn't, yeah.
So I always felt kind of grateful to that guy.
So that was your ticket home?
That was my ticket home. Then I found out that if I had survived another day, the battle would have been over anyway.
Mm-hmm. Did you, how long was your recovery from the shoulder wound?
It was the damnedest thing. They put me in a cast that started above at the navel, went all around my body, and held my arm up level with my shoulder, mm-hmm. this cast, somehow. I saw a picture of the x-ray of the bone, and it went right through the bone, where the arm meets the shoulder, mm-hmm. and at the top of the bone, it swells out the way your hand does from your wrist. Mm-hmm. And it went right through the center. That was a beautiful sunburst on the x-ray. I wish I'd been able to hang on to that. It'd be fun to light that up.
Have that mounted in your office?
Yeah. But now that I've gone through having my knee replaced and all the rehabilitation that accompanies that, I'm amazed at the fact that there was no physical rehab at all. In this recovery period, I never felt any pain or whatever, shock, I suppose, mm-hmm. prevented that. But some of the guys carried me down this hillside. Put me on a jeep down there. And then the jeep drove down to a little airfield. And at that airfield, there was a bubble helicopter, just big enough for the pilot. You couldn't even have a passenger inside, but a couple of stretchers were rigged up on the outside of that little bubble helicopter. And I had never even seen a helicopter before, mm-hmm. so they put me on there. And by now it's almost dark, and the pilot says to me, you know, he says, all day long, he says, a Jap sniper has been trying to get me. He says, it's just my luck, he'll get me this time. I thought, thanks a lot.
So you didn't have the benefit of an ambulance ride?
No, I never.
When you were wounded, then.
Yeah, that's right.
Even though you'd had experience as an ambulance driver.
I'm having a hell of a time remembering the mm-hmm. details of that. I don't know how people remember all the details.
Yeah. Well, the trauma, too, of that, and obviously it's a natural.
So I ended up first on Guam in a mm-hmm. hospital there. I was the only non-Marine in a ward of something like 30 people, mm-hmm. 29 Marines and me. And so day after day for about a month, I'd listen to these guys talk about the goddamn Army's no good, you know, they won't move ahead. And I felt like saying, you guys might want to ponder this fact. There's 29 of you and one of me. That tells us something about your tactics as against ours. But I never let on. I wasn't a Marine. Yep. I think God, they'd probably assassinate me in my sleep if they found that I wasn't one of them. Yeah. And then I wound up in a hospital in Walla Walla, Washington, uh-huh. for something like 2 months, uh-huh. with my arm in this damn cast all that time. Yeah. So as I'm going out of the hospital, there was a legionnaire at a card table by the door. He says, hey, buddy, come on over. Well, I wasn't going to. I figured Marines are fascists, you know, the busting strikes in the 30s and mm-hmm. hostile to the First Amendment and all that sort of thing. Said, oh, no, he'll know. No, come on. Well, nobody's waiting for me or anything. I thought, why not? So I go over. He says, have you put in for disability? Classification, something like that. I said, no. I said, I don't feel disabled. I can move my arm okay. Well, he said, we found out after World War I, if you don't apply for disability status right at the time you're discharged, and then 20 years later, you're incapacitated because this catches up with you, you can't apply then. So he said, look, we'll fill out all the papers. You just sign this one piece of paper here, and we'll handle the whole thing for you. So I applied, and I was classified 10% disabled. Mm-hmm. So then, at the risk of carrying this story on beyond your patience, I go back up to Seattle, re-enrolled. About a year after I was discharged, I got a letter from the VA saying, we're re-examining all the classifications of disabled military personnel, so you go down to some doctor's office in Seattle and he'll give you a physical exam. So I was in good shape by this time. I was playing handball and whatnot. I was about 175 pounds, I guess. So I got down there, and this doctor turns out to be small and thin. And he said, now what I'm going to do first is, he says, you shake hands, if we're just shaking hands, and I'm going to push against, I want to see how that shoulder works, forward, back, okay. Well, I get into some kind of a game with this guy for some crazy reason, and I just pushed him right up against the wall. So then he said, now, he said, we try it laterally. I want to see how it goes when I push your arm out. Well, I practically picked him up off the floor up against his desk. So then he says, one more try, and try it the other way. I flipped him up over against the filing cabinet or something. He says, well, I think I have enough information now. I'll be damned if the guy didn't confirm my classification as disabled.
It's 10%.
Now, see, that's not resistance to authority. That's just idiocy, that kind of behavior. But it was beautiful because as a partially disabled person, I had a better GI Bill, mm-hmm. called it mm-hmm. Public Law 16, mm-hmm. which meant I got a more generous living allowance, a more generous book allowance, and I think it carried me farther into graduate school than the regular GI Bill.
Would you talk a little bit about the GI Bill and how it influenced you and your studies?
Well, it certainly influenced me because it meant I could continue on after the master's if I wanted to, and by that time, I was trying to figure out what the hell am I going to do now? I still had no clear idea of what I wanted to do, mm-hmm. which gave me a lot of empathy with students who didn't know whether they wanted to be engineers or accountants or salespeople or whatnot. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I was talking with one of my profs one day about this, and I said, you know, I can tell you a lot of things I do not want to do. By this time, I was active in the ACLU in Seattle. My wife and I helped establish a branch there. And
were you married at the time?
Yeah, got married not long after I was discharged. Mm-hmm. It was another.
In 1945 or 46?
46.
46.
Another good thing because my wife insisted that I keep my nose to the grindstone. She was supporting me in part. Mm-hmm. And so I became a serious student. But anyway, I knew the Truman Loyalty Program was just getting started at that time. And I wasn't fearful that they'd find out that I'd been in the YCL, which they never did as far as I know. But I just didn't like the political climate and the idea of working for the government and having to toe the line and you avoid being accused. You know, in those days, people in the Loyalty Review Program would be asked, is it true that you had a Negro for dinner at your house? And if you did, see, they'd question your loyalty. Mm-hmm. That's how low level that was, with no appeal mm-hmm. at the beginning of that thing. So, okay, that took care. I don't want to work for government. I don't want to work for a corporation. To me, a corporation was IBM with a hat that looked like an FBI man's snap brim hat that's straight, mm-hmm. a dark suit, a white shirt and a dark tie, you know, that dress code they had. I figured that's out. And somehow, shortly after I got out of the Army, before I was married, I decided to augment my income. So I got a job as a father substitute in a center for disturbed kids. And there'd be like 20 kids ranging in age from maybe 3 years all the way up to 18, living in this big big house.
Group home type?
A group home, yeah. Mm-hmm. So they had a father substitute and a mother substitute, college age people, during the day, and then another set in the overnight. So I got a job in this place. And almost immediately I realized that the people working there, the social workers, were extremely unhappy with their working conditions and their salaries and so on. And when I went down and I joined the CIO Office of Professional Workers. See, my contention was I was a professional. And they were happy to have me, so mm-hmm. So I thought, well, I'll organize this group. And these are people who were carrying a New York newspaper called PM, which was sort of like the Nation magazine. They'd have that in their pocket, you know, sort of mm-hmm. a symbol to everybody else. I'm a liberal. So I thought, this would be duck soup organizing people. Turned out quite the contrary. They're all scared to join the union. But after a couple of weeks of talking to them, the head of this treatment center called me in. This was a woman who was about 40, I think, a psychiatric social worker. She seemed pleasant enough, but anyway, she...